Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe, today. Glad you're with us. Our goal on Central Coast Voices is to bring you credible and valid information and insights from diverse members of our community. Central Coast Voices addresses how today's choices, or sometimes lack of choices, will affect tomorrow's community and how we look at the long-term ramifications of changes in our society, oftentimes in cases of history in our society, which we're going to talk about a little bit more today. I'm glad you're with us today. I want to thank KCBX Public Radio and the folks at the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County for underwriting and collaborating to do this program with us. We're going to talk today about celebrating nature, and we're going to talk about celebrating nature in a fashion that probably should be well-known to everybody, but it really isn't. In a lot of cases, our natural surroundings and how we use them and how we keep them, how we preserve them, really become part of our community history. And it's really part of how we look at the society we are and the region we are. The indigenous Chumash peoples have helped us to hear and pay attention to that history. And some of us haven't been real good listeners. Some of us have been better listeners. But it's really part of what we want to talk about today. In collaboration with the San Luis Obispo Botanical Garden, the Chumash community has put together some educational programs. We're going to talk about the history of the Chumash peoples on the Central Coast, but also about the Botanical Garden's upcoming project called Chumash Kitchen, which is going to be this Saturday, and we'll tell you how you can get more information about that and participate in that. We really want to talk about, among other things, how the Chumash peoples have worked and endeavored for a long time to honor and preserve our connection with nature. For those of us who are Anglos, we understand that an awful lot of us don't pay attention to honoring and preserving that, and that's why we want to have part of that discussion today. And one of the reasons why the Botanical Garden is involved in this, because part of their educational work is to look at both the environmental issues and the way they're tied to our communities. They have issues that they look at in their educational programs with fire-safe practices for gardening, children's gardening, culinary demonstrations, which we'll talk about today, and life-celebrating gardens, among other things. My guests today are Lindsay Collinsworth Morgan. She's the educational director for the San Luis Obispo Botanical Garden, and Violet Sage Cavanaugh. She is a member of the Northern Chumash Tribe, and she is, I guess, at this point, you're a councilwoman and also the co-chair of the tribal council, I believe. And she is the one who is putting on the program this Saturday, which we'll get into a lot of details for. But I've met Violet before and interviewed her before on a program dealing more with history of the Chumash people, and it's a fascinating topic, and we will have a good time talking about that today. Violet, why don't we start with a definition of what the Chumash Kitchen is and what you're planning to do this Saturday, because if we don't start there, we might lose track of why we started to have this program.
Right. Well, first, I'd like to thank you for having us here. It's always a great time for us to support KCBX Public Radio, and we love coming on the show. And I've been on the show a few times. We can't remember why at the moment, but but I know it was something important. And yeah, I'm really excited about this weekend. I'm really excited about the Chumash Kitchen. It came to us as an idea. A friend of mine, Jeanette Costa, and Lindsay and I, we had sat down and we had brainstormed a way to use the Botanical Gardens because we love the Botanical Gardens. It's a beautiful place. There's a lot of sites there, a lot of Chumash sites there up on the top of the hill, grinding rocks, and there's a lot of great landscaping and culture and just, the creeks. And it's a really great place to spend time at. So we went to the facilities and it was set up perfect for doing food events. And we love to cook because in order for us to get any of our people anywhere, you have to feed them. So Nobody will show up to any event that's Chumash or Native American related if there's not food. So that's the one thing.
That's pretty cross-cultural, I think.
Yeah, that's the one thing our grandma and our elders, and she said, well, if you don't feed people, they're not going to come. So when we had initially years ago, like 20, 25 years ago, when we started having meetings with the San Luis Chumash community, and that was the kind of the rules that we fed everybody. So when we went out to the botanical gardens and started this collaboration with Lindsay in the gardens, it was about feeding people, but, you know, people will come for food, all cultures, everybody will come if there's food. But also they really want something deeper, a deeper connection. They want to know, our history, our stories. And so I'm part of, local organizations. And we always say, you know, we should build a bigger table, not a higher wall. That's kind of, our.
Okay. That's a very good point. Thank you. Continue.
Yeah, so
I didn't mean to stop the conversation.
So building a bigger table, having everyone, it kind of means a lot of different things to us because, a lot of times the Chumash people don't have a seat at the table, whether it's at the county or the city or, some type of government, related issue dealing with our local natural resources or building or development or whatever the issue is. So having a seat at the table is very symbolic, but also feeding people and bringing together people with food is really, the kind of the focal point of our culture is once you feed people, they will come and then you can get, your business taken care of that you have to deal with. So that was the kind of vision behind Chumash Kitchen, and the botanical gardens is a great place for us, and it kind of gave us like a home base. And there's a lot of community already out there at the Botanical Gardens, and it's just a beautiful facility. So we love being out there with Lindsay.
Okay. Lindsay, how does this fit into the overall mission for you at the Botanical Garden?
Well, the mission of the Botanic Garden is to honor and preserve our connection with nature, which you said like first thing at the beginning of the show. And we do part of our vision is to help promote and educate on the plants and their importance to humans, looking at cultural as well as storytelling, artistic food, just sort of learning all about different plants and how people rely on them in hopes that people will start to care about the plants once they know a little bit more. So we've got a vision to have different gardens based on Mediterranean climate zone plants. And what's better than learning about the plants in your backyard and the amazing people that have tended these plants for eons? I'm a huge fan of learning about local plants and how I can integrate them into my life. I've been studying herbology for like years and years. I finished up a master's in teaching biology, and I wanted to concentrate on ethnobotany. So this just kind of like came at the right time. I was introduced to Violet and Jeanette through another wonderful organization called Outside Now, who's also their focus is on nature education and keeping kids outside. So it was kind of just like this perfect trifecta of things that I love, wonderful like people that wanted to share information, and then this kind of connecting glue of Outside Now to like, hey, you guys should talk and get something going. So I found that classes where I take kids out hiking and show them the different plants, the ones that they remember the most are the ones that I can give them a piece of and have them chew on it or use it to like help get rid of a bug bite, and because they have some hands-on practical application of how to use these plants, they come back, oh my gosh, like I love this, can we go back out and like find that again? And like I showed this to my mom and she was all excited, and then we went on a hike and I showed some friends, and it just had this nice ripple effect. It's like, let's try it with adults, this is a great opportunity. So we do still work with Outside Now, and they're going to come and help with their younger kids on Friday to help with some of the collecting and processing at the Chumash Kitchen. But ultimately, sorry, I tangented.
No, that's fine. No, that's I think that's very good. It's we think of botanical gardens, and maybe I'm not a good example because I can by the way do no gardening. I'm allowed to figure out why the drip system in our house isn't working, but other than that, I leave all plants alone.
Yeah.
But we think of botanical gardens as, if you will, primarily a visual experience.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that's historically, I think, what botanical gardens have been, something to go to come look at, a peaceful environment to sit in and reflect in and things like that. So looking at it from a standpoint of two key things, indigenous plants and what we eat,
mm-hmm.
seems like a great tie together. In my hunch is it also brings you people to the garden that don't often show up otherwise.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The big movement of DIY or do-it-yourself type stuff, people are all about like wildcrafting or urban foraging, just all this stuff. So it's like, well, we should teach people how to do it in a respectful manner, in a way that's not going to hurt themselves or the environment. And what's even better, like, hey, you should just plant one of these native plants at your house, in your yard, and then you could have it like whenever you want.
Yeah, and if it was growing here before when nobody needed to tend to it very well, it'll probably grow here again, even if you have no idea what you're doing.
So perfect and, for somebody who can't garden.
But I'd like to just throw in there that when it was growing here before, we did tend it. So most people think it was, you know, this hands-off approach to the environment. Mm-hmm. Like we left things, how they are and without human interaction. But that was actually not true because we practice a lot of selective harvesting and burning, and we trimmed up our favorite trees that gave us the best, you know, acorns or gave us the best toyon berries, and all the food that we like, we took care of. So the food, just like we do now, like the things that you like and things you want to keep, you tend. And so if you can imagine, 10, 15,000 people pre-contact, like 1492, okay. Living here in Avila, and all those people had their favorite berry bushes and their favorite, toyon bushes and their favorite acorn trees, like the best acorns, and people had, stuff that they took care of all of it. So this idea with like tending the wild, is really true. We took care of the food that we like to eat. So,
yeah. I suspect in some factors that come into play. I mean, we're in the middle of a very serious drought right now. The ability to tend to those plants before there was elaborate irrigation systems may have been tough. And what did the Chumash tend to do, or what methods did they use for irrigation?
Well, not irrigation per se, but definitely. Right now we're being faced with climate change, whatever you want to call it, global warming, climate change, and we're facing more extreme weather than we've ever had. And we in this area, like pre-contact, there was recorded droughts, long history of droughts, but we were used to that. And so we were able to adapt to what was available at the season. So if there wasn't going to be a good acorn harvest, maybe we would have to travel and get pine nuts or get some other things to supplement. But we knew where things were, and we knew based on the weather patterns what we could harvest 6 months to a year down the road. And so that's what we have to like look at with the Chumash Kitchen. Even today, people ask us, when can we harvest acorns? Well, we harvest for next year. So when we think about it now, we're preparing for next year. So when we look at food, we look at, a cycle of a year or two or 5 years, and we have to really plan ahead too. So,
yeah. When you were both sending us some original information to give me an opportunity to put together the questions for the program and mm-hmm. things like that, you both talked about the fact that a recurring question is, will we process, or when can we process, or how do we process acorns?
Oh my gosh, Fred. The acorn thing.
Okay.
I mean, we could be talking about.
You can't blame it on me. You put that question on your list of
questions. I put a frowny face with the tongue sticking out, and I'm like, not the acorns.
Yeah. Okay. But, so, well, I guess then I don't want it to be an answer to the question of when you do that. Mm-hmm. I want maybe the question is, why does everybody assume that should be the key answer?
I'll tell you why is because, there's probably 50 reasons why, but nobody,
we've got a while to go.
Nobody has ever, that is not indigenous, I maybe not ever, but I'd say pretty close, and nobody knows how to make acorns taste good. That's the issue, you know, unless you know what to do with them. I mean, you know they're there, and you know that they're edible, but people don't know what to do with them so that they can eat them.
Okay, I don't know how to get them out of the shell without whatever's left when I open the shell to just be mashed into nothing. Okay, but
so and the other thing too is that we have we're kind of unique here with our protection of the coastal oaks and the live oaks and all of our oak trees. How many do you know, Lindsay, offhand? How many oak trees we have here? How many different varieties? I want to say
it would be
dozens.
A ballpark, but yeah.
Dozens of varieties of protected oak trees, and people are not allowed to cut these down. They're not allowed. I mean, they have these oak trees, right?
Yeah.
And they're majestic. They know they're protected, and they know that there's acorns there. So it's like they have these oak trees on their property, and they know there's food there. Mm-hmm. And they're just curious. It's real curiosity, I think, more than anything, is that the oak trees are, you know, a symbol for us. On how many people's logos do you see oak trees, and how many people's, you know, businesses you have oak, you know, referring to oak trees and the California live oaks? They're just beautiful. The Spanish oaks and the rolling hills, and they know that there's food there. Mm-hmm. And so I think more than anything, I think it's just fascination, you know?
Yeah. And I'm wondering if, again, that wild harvesting, wild crafting, paired with some really nice maybe Pinterest posts got people all like, oh, I can do that. That looks great. But when they try it, they're like, wow.
Okay.
Pinterest. Working with acorns probably definitely predates Pinterest. Yeah. So we're lucky in that standpoint.
I know. I think that is funny because when we talk about, you know, the drought, and we talk about how we survived here, and we didn't have famine per se in this area like some other places would have, but that was because we had abundant fish, seafood. We had abundant like acorns, deer, elk, all these animals coming through. And you know, you look at the acorn as like a symbol of you know, an affluent society and a society that was not food insecure. Mm-hmm. So when you think about what does it take to make art and to make jewelry and to sing and dance, well, those people that had that time, those native indigenous people that had the time to really flourish and really have like trading and specialized skills and all this stuff, they had food security. And so when we look at the acorn, that kind of is like a symbol of like our food security. And so and we look at that, you know, as long as, you know, the ocean and other things that we had too, but the acorn's really a powerful thing for us.
That's a very good perspective on that, because I'm sure sometimes it's a frustrating the way that you put it in your notes, it was kind of sometimes it's a frustrating question to have to answer.
It's funny. It makes me laugh. We could be having the most serious talk, you know, about really important things all around the world, and people still will end the conversation with, "Do you know how to process acorns?"
See, now I'm sorry. See, in my mind of what's important as far as food is, my first question would be, how did you get ice cream without refrigeration? And obviously you didn't, what's important to you? And ice cream is more important to me than acorns.
We do have modern contemporary food in with our meals. I think last time we had an apple cobbler, we got Sea Canyon apples.
Oh my,
and
yes.
And I was actually born and raised in Sea Canyon in Avila. So I'm like, you know, the biggest fan of Sea Canyon apples. So we went and got Sea Canyon apples, and then we made a cobbler topping with acorns. It was like a crunchy, nutty cobbler topping with acorns.
Yeah.
And then we put you know, vanilla ice cream with it, and then we put like crunchy acorn crumbles on the top of the vanilla ice cream, and it was to die for.
This is how you get people to come out on Saturday, right?
Okay. Right?
It's like, okay. But it's beyond acorns and it's beyond indigenous plants.
I know. I'm going to get it my involves shirt is going to say apple, beyond acorns. Yeah,
apple cobbler and ice cream. Okay. We really aren't digressing, folks. If you're just joining us and listening today, I have Lindsay Morgan, who's the educational director of the SLO Botanical Garden, San Luis Obispo Botanical Garden, and Violet Cavanaugh, and she is a Chumash elder and a co-chair of the
I'm not an elder yet.
Oh, that's okay.
Just to be clear, Fred.
Okay, well I thought since you were the co-chair of
I'm a lot younger than.
Okay. Oh, I see. I didn't think in the Chumash culture that elder had to do with age as much as it had to do with station. So
I don't have my AARP card yet, so I'm not going to go with
that.
An
was
elder.
Cruel because I am definitely the oldest person in the room, and maybe by double some of your ages. But anyway. Okay, so you are the co-chair of the
Northern Chumash Tribe.
Tribal County. What is the? Can you tell us a little bit about the structure and the way that the Chumash community has kept itself together? Let me preface that before you answer. I understand that the. I want to use the word, sorry, infiltration of Anglo-Saxon.
Occupation, infiltration.
infiltration of North America by an awful lot of the European influences did the very best they could to try and make sure that any of the tribal connections got broken up. Mm-hmm. If we could find a way to take groups of hundreds or thousands of people and make sure that they were only now groups of only three or four or less, mm-hmm. we could control you.
Right.
And so I think to some extent the historical connections of the tribes had been lost at one point in a lot of cases and now rekindled a lot.
So I think maybe what you're asking is how we did things before contact, which is more realistic, like – that was how things were done.
Thank you. That is the best rephrasing of a disconnected question I've ever done.
Let me help you with that.
I appreciate that.
So one of the things interesting about the Chumash culture and most California cultures is that they were matrilineal. So the line and the rule usually went through the female line instead of a patrilineal, which is what we're used to now mostly. And so it was also more of a collective and a council. So, decisions were made by groups of people, and they weren't from the top down. They were more from the bottom up with a mutual understanding, because we had to, cooperate. The person that you might be living next to might be saving your life, tomorrow. And we really relied on like community cooperation and also mutually beneficial and by consensus. So wealth was measured, in various different items like trade beads, status, like lineage, heritage, what you owned, what your skills were. Wealth was measured very similar to what we do today. People that are doctors or have really like great jobs. We had those people too, but it was a different hierarchy, and it was based more on the leaders of the community were people who were the best at what they did, the best at providing for people, the best at organization, the best at voluntarily taking care of the rest of the community. So if you think about, who our elected officials are today and stuff, those people would be responsible for, making sure everybody in the community, no one went hungry, everybody had what they needed. And that was, who we looked to back then too. So very, a little bit different, but still very well organized and The Chumash people, like I said before, we had a lot of food and resources here. So we had, you know, the opportunity to develop these amazing, like, basket weaving techniques, and the tamal, or ocean-going canoes and vessels and stuff, became an entire society of seafaring, you know, people. And if you think about us in, like, these redwood canoes, we paddled away from land, and we navigated by the stars and in open ocean. And there was no cell phones back then. So so if you think about, you know, when you send off 12 people in a canoe and you may or may not ever see them again, I mean, these were really strong, resilient people, and with really advanced, like, astronomy, astrology, technology, canoe making, all these things were just super advanced and amazing.
Yeah. Do you, with your current records, how large is the Chumash community on the Central Coast now? Number of people who still identify themselves as Chumash?
That would vary. There's, you know, probably under 100 people in all of San Luis County. And maybe of those 100 people, maybe 5 to 10 are active in the community. So, you know, it's hard to quantify. We have a lot of relatives, and there's 7 different groups of Chumash people, from Bakersfield to Santa Barbara to the Coastal Band to Ventura Barbarinos, two Ventura groups and the reservation. And so there's 7 different recognized tribal nonprofit groups. But of those groups, you know, we have a lot of relatives, but whether they're active or not in their culture, whether they know anything about it, you know, that remains to be seen. So maybe a handful of people.
Yeah. Going as far north as, like, San Juan Bautista and up that area too, and Monterey County?
We generally say, like, the county line is about where the, you know, the San Miguel Mission and that area went into, like, a different community's territory. So San Luis Obispo County is northern Chumash area, and then Santa Maria River turns into the reservation's territory and Coastal Band on the coastline going down Highway 1 and 101.
So where the evolution of your work with, because I looked at some of the bio information that was given to us by the Botanical Garden. You do work with natural body products and essence oils and things like that. And that's not an uncommon thing to be involved in our current culture, regardless of your background in the Chumash culture. But how did that all come tied together for you?
I think the first time I started making things for other people to use, I was at a gathering of Native people. We were at ceremony. And I learned from another lady up in Paiute area, up in like Kern River in that area. Mm-hmm. And she taught me how to make some of these indigenous plants into salves and ointments and massage oils and different things. And I said, well, you know, I love plants, and I grew up with plants. I grew up in Sea Canyon on a 100-acre apple farm, and all my grandma did was grow plants. And, you know, our medicine and everything that we had was growing in the garden. So I grew up that way. But then when a friend of mine taught me, and people like Jeanette and some of these other people taught me about making these salves into things that other people could use. And the first thing I make was the creosote salve, which is a chaparral. It's a chaparral or greasewood. Do you know the botanical name?
It'll come to me.
I know, put Lindsay on the spot. With that. But it grows up and down the high desert. There's the creosote rings out in Death Valley.
Yes.
And people are like, "Is that the stuff you paint on the fence?" I'm like, "No, I do not sell you painting. You know the stuff you paint on railroad ties. No, that's not it." But the creosote monument is the creosote rings, and the mother plant is in the middle. And when she sends out her runners, and they form like about 50 to 100 foot circle around her, and then she dissolves in the middle. And so you see like over 5 to 10,000 years, the mother plant will die. And then the ring around the mother was all her offspring. And they can be 10,000 years old. It's amazing.
Oh my, yeah.
So that's kind of the first plant I really loved. That's the first plant I bottled to sell retail to other people. And it's still one of my favorite plants.
Yeah. Lindsay, we're not going to put – you don't need to come up with the actual botanical name for those plants. Thank you.
I should have told her ahead of time.
It's okay. But she'll know – you'll know next time. That's okay. This is – The cultural tie to the environmental things that the botanical garden looks at are obviously a very positive way to educate people and to bring people into a broader understanding of our environment. So what other things is the botanical garden doing in this kind of direction?
To connect people, like, culturally to nature,
yes,
or just general connections with nature?
You can make it as broad as you like.
Okay. We have programs almost monthly out there at the Botanic Garden, and they range on a variety of different topics. From pruning, just people to get to know their plants better and to take care of their plants in a way that will lead to greater fruit production or just ease or beauty. Just bird walking.
The pine needle.
Uh-huh. Arts and craft type things are skills based on, plants. So we've done a plant tie-dye class, and the pine needle basket weaving workshop is always super popular. Aside from that, we have docent-led tours that we lead and tours for kids that range from, little teeny tots to college age students, but a lot of them focus also on cultural uses of plants and kind of that connecting between, the little teeny tots will learn that some plants have different flavors associated with them and plants have the same similar needs that humans need. I'm like, oh, wow, I had no idea that a plant was even alive, says the little teeny one. And another one's like, wow, I didn't know you could eat that berry or that the birds like this particular tree. There's so many different ways to connect people to nature that I love science and experimenting. And so to see what this community is interested in and how to kind of pull them in for different reasons, but also just end up leaving them with a, hey, and we got to preserve our environment because we need it.
One of the things that that was in the notes that you gave us is that a lot of people ask you about what other than acorns, what native or wild plants around here are really are foods, and I think for a lot of people, when you talk about children especially, they don't know what is edible and what, and there are things that you can eat that won't harm you, but may give you no food value. Mm-hmm. But an awful lot of people have no idea what's available as far as indigenous plants that they could really do something with.
Oh yeah,
besides acorns,
there's a whole bunch of them, and that's kind of a teaser for our Chumash Kitchen program again. So seasonally, you'll find these different plants.
So So what people see a lot of around here, besides the obvious, is elderberry. People love elderberry, so you see it growing all along the road, all along the freeway. So we do elderberry tea because that's really easy to do. It's really tastes great. It's really fun. But we also will do later in the season when the elderberries are ripe, people can cook down the elderberries into like a cough syrup and stuff. When their kids are sick, they can use an elderberry cough syrup, and it's really good for the flu. It's really good for a sore throat. But it tastes great. It tastes like blackberries it tastes really good. So you can do like an elderberry jam like over your favorite, like over ice cream.
Sorry I brought up ice cream. Okay.
When Lindsay and I we're at the garden, like people are like, what do you do with like manzanita? Well, we'll dry it out. We'll make like a manzanita dressing. So it'll be this creamy, like amazing salad dressing with manzanita berries. And people think that it's going to be maybe simple. Like their idea, the food might be simple, but this is like gourmet, like, you know, 4 or 5 star restaurant type food. We did like a wild salmon one time, and we did it like crusted with like a wild black sage, and we baked it, and then we put the manzanita dressing on top of it. And I mean, it is amazing what you can incorporate these native foods into like these gourmet dishes. Mm-hmm. So, what was your favorite?
I keep thinking back to the toyon,
yeah.
Just because the story of its Latin name is Heteromeles, and they grow next to and around different species, so hetero, just different. I would always see, you know, these toyon trees growing next to eucalyptus or all kinds of other things. It's like, I didn't think that other plants necessarily liked these more or less invasive eucalyptus trees, and there they are, just growing up. And as a kid, you learn, like, stay away from red berries, never eat a wild red berry that you don't know what it is. And these are just the most beautiful bright red berries. They're like the center picture on our poster there. And not only did the birds love them, but they're so tasty. And they're also ripe in the middle of winter. So they're kind of one of those fun, special things that, you know, they look kind of neat. That was another plant that we focused on for our plant tie-dye class, mm-hmm. also, because they turn this really nice oxblood color, like your shirt. But
they taste great.
They taste great.
We made a syrup with them, toyon, like red berry syrup. And did we put it over like an acorn crepes?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And acorn and blue corn.
And then we did
toyon syrup over acorn crepes.
And okay. We filled it with
I wanted to repeat that to make sure that everybody heard that, because it's outside our realm of what we think of,
right?
as we want to eat this.
And so that's great. Wait till you hear the filling. I think we use wild rose hips, and we made wild rose hips because they taste great when you infuse them with cream. So we filled the crepes with wild rose hips, cream filling, and drizzled like toyon syrup over them. It was really good.
It was pretty.
So is anybody listening to the program right now that comes on Saturday, you guys should be prepared for the fact they may want to have you do this again.
Yes. We're going to try and do it 4 times a year. And we're never going to do the same thing. And we can't do the same thing ever, because the seasons are always different.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You know, I'm looking outside, I'm driving around, and I really wanted to feature yucca on Saturday. And the yucca that I really want is going to mean that I have to hike this mountain to get it. And so it's I'm going to, for these people, I'm going to sacrifice my safety to hike this mountain for this yucca plant. But yucca blossoms, and they taste like artichokes.
You're the co-chair of the council. You should be able to delegate this to someone.
Well, I'm the youngest also.
So who told you the youngest had to do it?
Well, it's just
led to believe.
You remember
that?
When we talked about the culture of how the young people have to do it.
Okay.
It's called being voluntold. You get volunteered and told to do something by someone older than you. You got to do it.
So we'll get back to it, and I'm sure we'll remind everybody. Okay, so let's talk about this Saturday at the Botanical Garden. At 8:30 in the morning.
Yes.
Okay. You want to give us some more details about how people can get information about this?
Certainly. On our website, which is slobg.org, which is the acronym for San Luis Obispo Botanic Garden .org.
That's good for people who can't spell botanical.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, also B and G sound similar to P and D all kinds of other funny ones. But right there on our website, there's a link to the Chumash Kitchen program. There's actually a Friday prep day also, so people can sign up for a 2-day program or just come Saturday and enjoy an amazing breakfast, some storytelling, some lessons
songs,
about the different plants.
Yeah. Circle, yeah.
Songs. And then, you know, just a whole bunch of different information they'll be able to participate in. And then lunch is also provided. So beyond that, yeah.
From my background, if you're dealing with food all day long and you don't eat, there's something wrong. Okay, so that's I'm glad that you said lunch was provided.
Oh yes, the lunch is the feature. When you show up in the morning and we check in, there will be a light breakfast, and we actually have a farm in Los Osos, so we are gathering and getting ready for this weekend already. So we have a bunch of chickens, and so we're going to do some. Like a quiche or something for breakfast, but the feature is the lunch. So the lunch is going to be an amazing lunch.
For those of you who may not have been with us for the whole program, this is Central Coast Voices, so that part you probably know. We have some wonderful folks from the Botanical Gardens and the Chumash community with us. And this Saturday they're having a program called the Chumash Kitchen at the Botanical Garden. And we'll make sure before the program's over we give you the contact information one more time. But it's fascinating to me the way you take something that we generally think of, and I mentioned it earlier in the program, as a botanical garden, which is a visual and aromatic environment, if you will, and look at it more from a standpoint of the practical uses of plants for food.
Yeah, botanic gardens have really had to evolve over the last handful of years. The very foundation of botanic gardens was to host and showcase different medicinal plants. That's where, you know, the king would go and have his apothecary pick whatever to help with the cold. And they've transitioned away from that into more just beautiful landscaping. But finding that people are needing more an additional connection. You know, they can see beautiful things online, on television. We live in a beautiful location. But how do we get people to, really care about the plants, the environment? You got to give them, what's in it for me type thing. That, I don't know, these green things grow in my backyard. I want to like them, or I want to at least tolerate them, or not have to maintain them. So kind of sharing with people different histories of plants kind of gives each plant a different personality almost. I hate to personify.
That's probably very good, especially when you're dealing with children, okay? Because that's an easy way for them to understand the differences between things.
Yeah, yeah. There's a term called green blindness, or just seeing green blobs. You know, it's they're plants. But once they know which one is fennel, and they go out and they eat the seeds and chew on the sticks and everything. It was a fun program that I did, really tired of invasive weeds and having to pull them. So it was if you can't beat it, eat it type hiking class. So showing them all the different non-native plants that they can go out and pick and what parts to use, and just these weeds are all over the place. Might as well help me out and come out and pull them and eat them. So now they know not only what these plants are, but that they're not native to the area and that it's good to over-harvest or pull up some of these plants. Whereas in the Chumash Kitchen program, focusing more on nature tending and planting of more of the native plants, as well as reasonable harvest and honoring the plants for, you know, the food and the energy and the beauty and just, I don't know, that inspiration of I want to put some toy on the top of my acorn crepe. That sounds delicious.
So that's interesting. I wanted to add something to what she just said is when we went to the botanical gardens before we started teaching there, the botanical gardens has, and you can help me out with this list, Lindsay, but We have Toyon out there. We have, of course, we have tons of acorns out there. We have the black sage, which is the best seasoning for tri-tips and barbecue, chicken.
Yes.
We have, calendula. We have elderberries. Okay. We have.
Back up. Say that. Congratulations. You came up with the name of a plant I've never heard of before. I'm sorry.
Calendula?
Calendula. What is that?
It's a is it a botanical name for a marigold?
Yeah. Angela officinalis.
Yeah. Okay, so it was a trick question. Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah. So calendula is what you'd use for like topically for like burns and cuts and scarring and stuff, but it's also a great food source. So you can put that in your salads. Help me with the rest of the list.
Oh, golly. Like yerba buena, there's wild strawberries. There are like blackberries out there. We've used...
did we get the pine for the pine tea out there?
Pine tea.
Pine tea is really great, too.
Oh, interesting.
Pine tea, cedar tea. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is so much stuff out there that... we can harvest a lot of what we need for the class right on the grounds if we do it at the right time. So we could almost have pop-up classes because when things are ready, we need to harvest them right then. So it's hard when we plan like a date out 4 months because really I wanted to be there a month ago. So the Botanical Gardens is a great place because they have planted everything that we need for seasonings and for main courses. And we can walk to the creek. We can hike up the mountain. We have all kinds of stuff that right there on the grounds. So
it's really been fun as through learning all this is you could like almost not see a plant that doesn't have some sort of health or food use. If you just look around, you're like, oh,
I realize this is not an indigenous plant. It's only been in this probably in this area for about 150 or 200 years, maybe a little longer. Is eucalyptus, but that's I think everybody now understands that the eucalyptus oil is good for. It's probably the best, in my opinion, one of the best things out there for non-chemical type of bug repellent.
Yeah. I actually make something like that.
eucalyptus keeps mosquitoes away better than any of the bad chemicals.
Plus,
I keep
bees, so the eucalyptus eucalyptus is the winter food source for our bees. So the bees would be starving on the coast here without eucalyptus in the winter. So,
but that's not an indigenous crop.
Neither are honeybees. So,
This is in the category of I hope I don't sound too ridiculously stupid about it. Is rosemary an indigenous crop here? Or was that planted by somebody who just decided to bring rosemary in?
Yeah, that one's native to the Mediterranean climate area. Yeah. The Mediterranean area. So that and lavender, which is another really good plant on the central coast. Those are from the Mediterranean areas. Mm-hmm. So
they grow great here.
Yeah.
And they love it here.
Rosemary's
same
everywhere.
Climate.
It's like the best large ground cover type of plant you can just have because you put it out there and it just grows forever.
And we have this plant I kind of call the wild rosemary. It's like that sagebrush looking rosemary. Oh. And I can't think of.
There's a woolly blue curl.
And it grows out at Montanduro.
Say that again. Woolly blue curl.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right.
But they'd call it like false rosemary or something because it smells little blue.
But you can also cook with that too.
Oh my gosh!
And so the other thing that I wanted to talk to a little bit about though was the botanical gardens. They're not just a garden per se. They have the best area for special events and the most beautiful pavilion that is. I mean, Lindsay could tell you more about it, but that pavilion is gorgeous. And, you know, is it adobe? Is it adobe brick?
It's a straw bale constructed.
So it's beautiful. And they have this patio area for like weddings and so I'm a member and on the board of directors for the Sierra Club. We're having our 50th anniversary this year and we rented the Botanical Gardens for our 50th later in October. And, it's a great venue for local, you know, community groups to use, whether it's a wedding or a special event. But I really would like encourage all of our local community organizations to go to the Botanical Gardens and rent that venue because it supports all these other educational things that we do.
Yeah. Straw bale buildings, wonderful air conditioning.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. It's the most comfortable place I've ever worked. It stays cool in the summer and warm in the winter. It was designed by Richard Bellow, who did also the a couple other like lead. I hope you can edit that.
No, can't.
All right. Polly Cooper and Richard Bello design lead amazing straw bale buildings. And you'll see a couple of them throughout the county. And so it works with the environment to stay cool when it's hot out and warm when it's cold out.
Yeah.
We recycle all of our water on site. We've got solar panels, so really trying to tout the location for eco events. People want to have like a smaller carbon footprint for their wedding or their anniversary event or their 50th anniversary of
I know, I'm so excited Sierra for Sierra Club.
We're down to a few minutes, and we've got a couple more minutes, but I want to get I want to make sure, because we haven't told people exactly where the botanical garden is, even though a lot of us have been there or know how to get there. Okay, so we might want to explain that to everyone if we can before we run out of time.
Thank you, and perfect question. We're located on Highway 1 across from Cuesta College. It's on Dairy Creek Road, and it's in El Toro Regional Park. It's a part of El Toro Regional Park. We've got 150 acres that's on the west side of the road there, and it goes up the hill. We've got hiking trails, children's garden, display garden, fire-safe demonstration garden, and then just a lot of wild space. There's also the gift shop and the Oak Glen Pavilion, or the education event pavilion area.
And
it's important. I want to make sure we get this in. That is, even though you're part of a county regional park, the botanical garden is not a government organization.
No.
Okay.
We're a very much a grassroots organization. So the county has a very generous land use agreement with us where, you know, 99 years we're able to build and grow and use that portion of the land. But we don't receive any government funds aside from grants that we apply for, like all other nonprofits. And I like to say to people that, you know, we're two staff and over 200 volunteer that help make the Botanic Garden what it is. It's pretty fun. You know, I work in the office all the time, and I get visitors, I've lived in the county for 20 years, and I've never been out here before. Yeah. It's great. We're free to the public. The park system does charge a $3 parking fee on weekends just through the summer season. But even with that $3 that you're paying to the county, thank you for supporting county parks, you can wander through the Botanic Garden all day and just enjoy for free.
Yeah. As most of our regular listeners know, I try and get out of the way a little more in the last few minutes. So you've got a couple of minutes to make sure that, is there any part we forgot about what information you'd like folks to know about for the Botanical Garden?
Oh, perfect. Our website is slobg.org. Again, the acronym for San Luis Obispo Botanic Garden. Also, if you just Google that, you'll find us. We have a Facebook page. You can follow us, learn about our upcoming events. We also started up an Instagram page, just kind of all kinds of fun, pretty pictures going on. It's a great way to connect with all different types of people. So check those out. Follow us. Be my friend. Come visit better. We also love donations and we love volunteers. So information on that is also available on our website. slobg.org, shameless. Just come on out and visit with me.
If you cannot trumpet your own organization, it's not going to do well. So that's understandable. Did, and I want to interject for a second. You did say, and I think it's important for people to know, that to visit the Botanical Garden, there is no admission charge.
True.
Okay. There is a charge for parking on Saturdays and Sundays only?
April through September.
Okay.
So come in the winter, come on the weekday, totally free. There is a sweet little donation box at the entrance of our bridge, so you feel free to drop in some cashola. That's very much appreciated, but nobody's going to be there asking for it.
Great. Thank you. Okay. Violet, so, your turn.
So the other thing about the Chumash Kitchen is that we wanted to increase revenue for the gardens. So we want people to come to the kitchen because a lot of that helps out the gardens, and it promotes people using the gardens. It promotes their nonprofit. It helps bring money to their organization. So by us having the Chumash Kitchen out there, they are actually getting more and more people interested in the gardens, more volunteers, more dedicated people out there, and more income. So as a nonprofit, you know how important it is to get more people, out there and using the place. So our elders always say, and I love this, that people, won't protect what they don't love. And that goes a long way because, we're going to talk a lot this next Saturday during the kitchen about the Carissa Plains. And I have a special relative and elder, Michael Kutz, who's the son of Palula Kutz, who's a Northern Chumash Bear Clan. And they're going to come and be a part of the kitchen on Saturday. And we're going to talk about the long, process and long history that we have with summer solstice at the Carissa Plains out of Painted Rock, and the years and years and years of the Chumash people, working with the BLM and working with all these landowners to protect the Carissa Plains. And we're going to feature some of the foods that we would have found out there during this time of year, if I can hike the hill and get the yucca. So, it's one of my favorite places in the county is out there, Painted Rock in the Carissa Plains. And it's a long way out there. The roads are bad. But if you don't go out there and see it, people won't know why it's so important to protect it, because it's amazing. It's beautiful out there. So you've been out to see the wildflowers, yes. Right? Oh, yeah. And I don't know if you've been out to the Rock, but the Rock is amazing. It's a magical place. So, this Saturday, people can still sign up until Friday to come out to the Chumash Kitchen, but they won't learn about Chumash people through a book. They won't learn about reading in the paper. They have to come out and spend time with us. That's the only way to really learn about our culture, and we want to share this information with as many people as possible. So,
I thank you for emphasizing that point, because that's a good place to wrap this up and a good point to make, because I think an awful lot of people don't realize that the continuity of culture and the environment is so
and
critical
food.
For us. And food, yes. And I thank you. Okay. This has been Central Coast Voices. Thank you for joining us today. I want to remind you that Chris Kington Barker will be with you next week. I'll be back in 2 weeks. Not quite sure. All the final details for Chris's program next week have not been finalized, but she will be with you. So please tune in next Thursday. And want to also remind you that Central Coast Voices is a production of Action for Healthy Communities, which is a project of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County, along with our wonderful support from KCBX and the listeners of Public Radio. We thank all of you. There's a report done called Action SLO, or Understanding San Luis Obispo County. It's available at actionslo.org. Gives you a snapshot of where we are, both economically, socially, and environmentally in San Luis Obispo County. You can reach us at 805-543-2323 or voices@kcbx.org. Thank you to Lindsay Morgan and Violet Kavanaugh for being my guest today. This has been Central Coast Voices. Next up is This American Life. Thank you for joining us today.